You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on
KISO
88.7
Avalon.
This is Ron Trupa with Catalina Film Radio. We're about to listen to an interview with John Lyons Murphy, who is the co-director, co-writer, and producer and editor of Kingdom Come. It's playing this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Hotel Metropole Conference Room. And you can come out and see his documentary film with A-list stars Mark Ruffalo, Don Cheadle, Ed Burns, Kevin Smith. It's basically the making of the movie Broken Kingdom, which won the Avalon Best Feature Award at the 2012 Catalina Film Festival this year, with Daniel Gillies, who wrote, directed, and produced that film, and also starred his wife Rachel Lee Cook, who also attended our 2012 Film Festival. Stay tuned, and you're about to hear the interview. Thanks for listening to Catalina Film Radio. This is Ron Trupa, and you're listening to Catalina Film Radio. I am on the phone right now with John Lyons Murphy. He is the producer, co-director, co-writer, editor of Kingdom Come, which is a documentary of the making of the film Broken Kingdom, which we had in the 2012 Catalina Film Festival, starring Daniel Gillies and Rachel Lee Cook and a plethora of other familiar faces and names. John, how are you?
Very well, very well. Thanks for having me on, man.
No problem, man. Thank you so much for letting us screen this at the Catalina Film Society this Saturday. We were big fans of the film. As you know, I think I stalked you from the Rhode Island International Film Festival almost a year before.
We appreciate the attention.
it's a great film. I mean, I guess we can start. Should we start with Broken Kingdom before we get into Kingdom Come, or do you want to start with Kingdom Come before Broken Kingdom? Because they're kind of one within.
Probably,
the same family.
I guess probably Broken Kingdom first. Probably the
okay.
It's a toss up.
Right,
can go either way, but
okay. Yes, I mean I saw Broken Kingdom at the Rhode Island Film Festival, and loved it. I spoke to Rachel and Daniel and Rachel's parents, and I was like, I need this out in Catalina. It's a great film. And one of the things that amazed me when I sat there in the audience was that we were delayed about 12 minutes before it screened. Because this guy named Daniel got up and he had to make sure the color was exactly right and it wasn't correct. And I'm like, what is going on? What, this better be amazing. I mean, he's got to mess with the color. And then I understood why. It's a really great piece and it really definitely plays a lot off of color. Just with the temperature and the room and the mood and the symbolism. I thought it was amazing. So, before we get into Kingdom Come, which is the making of, and we're almost going to cover this in the interview, what was that whole process like during the filming?
Well, during the filming, actually, Broken Kingdom, during the actual filming, like production, it went really pretty smooth with a couple exceptions. Daniel is he's a consummate preparer, so he went out and as far as on the acting side, because of his acting background, he would take his actors and he would rehearse and rehearse and rehearse for months before shooting, which is, extremely rare for any kind of film, much less a little indie movie where you don't have, $2 to scrape together. And so when we actually got the set, that side of it was really, really smooth. He, being the writer-director, knew the script incredibly well. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. He did a ton of preparation with the director's photography on both shoots in LA and Bogota. So, it actually went really smooth. The only real exception was we lost a day in LA due to one of our actors showing up and not really knowing lines or having read what they were supposed to do. So that was a bit tricky, but we ended up having to sort of reshoot one day here. Other than that, it was really smooth, and Daniel knew what he wanted, and he's pretty relaxed on set, which is really great because
as everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, people worked really hard, but actually our days were relatively short for indie film stuff, and it went really quite well.
That's awesome. I mean, I guess you know, and we'll get more into this with Kingdom Come, but you had plenty of time to prepare, so I guess that preparation all kind of helped just kind of know systematically exactly what you wanted by the time you got there. And
that's right, yeah. You know, and not to say that there weren't things that we could have done better, obviously, but, and, you know, there was one sort of storyline from the original script that we ended up shooting in Bogota and completely cutting out at the end of the day. So, you know, there's always sort of stuff like that, but, yeah, production-wise, it was pretty smooth.
I guess we could kind of talk about Kingdom Come because it's kind of hand in hand. So you were the producer or one of the producers on Broken Kingdom, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I was the lead producer.
Right. So you were the lead producer on Broken Kingdom. And when did, I guess, or unless you already knew this by the time you got there, when did you have the idea of starting Kingdom Come, which was basically even during the development and pre-production stage of Broken Kingdom, you know, when did you say, I'm going to actually make this documentary making of, or was it kind of one fed the other, and you're like, this is so crazy, we've got to document it? And
yeah,
on your resume that you've worked on other documentaries, including Moonshine to the Finish Line, and I'm sure this is incomplete because IMDb always misses credits, but so you had some documentary film experience.
Yeah, I've been on a few docs, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I guess the process that Daniel and I went through raising money for Broken Kingdom, an arduous one, I guess, you know, and we sort of decided very early on that we were going to pursue only this movie. We weren't going to be, Daniel wasn't going to be taking other acting gigs, and I wasn't going to be going out and producing other things or working at other places and doing other jobs. So we were raising money, and pretty quickly we raised, you know, about half of the budget. That's not true. At the time it was about $200,000 out of $1 million budget. We did that pretty quickly, and then over the course of the next, year and a half, we hit a wall where we couldn't really raise any more money, and we had shot the first half of the movie, and we were just going into meeting after meeting where it was, hey, you know, I'll cut you the check for this for the rest of the movie, but you've got to put more famous people in it. Now, if you've seen Broken Kingdom, we had already shot the L.A. portion of the movie. The portion that takes place in Bogota, Colombia, there weren't any more roles for quote-unquote famous people. The only role sort of left out there, which is one of the leads in the piece, is for a 15-year-old Colombian girl. And we kept getting sort of, you know, put Ryan Gosling in it, or put Woody Harrelson in it, or put this person or that person in it, who has a foreign, you know, foreign sales value. You know, those guys are great actors, but they're not good enough to play a 15-year-old Colombian girl. Like, it's just impossible. There's no roles left. So,
right.
You know, my solution in my head was, all right, well, if we can't put somebody in this movie, it's going to help us finance it. How about if we leverage all these relationships? Because, you know, especially Daniel and Rachel being actors, being around for a long time, they know a lot of other actors, a lot of other known people. So we said, well, what if we do a documentary about, you know, indie film finance and use our story as the A story? And then for the B story, we get as many sort of known faces as we can to talk about their own struggles and triumphs in indie film finance and indie film. And, you know, we'll put this documentary project as a sort of bonus to Broken Kingdom. So if you come in with a check to make the rest of Broken Kingdom happen, you're going to get this great piece for free. So if we make any money on that, you're going to get a piece of that, as well as you're going to have this really unique, never been done before sort of synergistic marketing component where essentially all the people in the documentary are going to be by extension sort of doing publicity and stumping for Broken Kingdom. So I thought that was a really, really unique and wonderful idea. So we just started essentially going out to people that we already knew, that were friends. You know, some of the first people that were in were people that were Daniel and Rachel's friends. And, you know, Seth Green and Brecken Meyer and sort of this kind of crew of people that they had known a long time. And then that sort of snowballed into, you know, where we eventually went with people like Mark Ruffalo and Don Cheadle, who we didn't actually know, but through, you know, one door or another, we kind of got to.
Right. And so were, in the end, was that kind of what you were able to package? Were you able to package them together as documentary and film based on what you just said? I mean, was that still an easier sell, or did that prove still kind of tough? Most people don't think there's a lot in documentaries aside from cable and, you know, there's not a lot of theatrical releases. Even when there are, there's not that much money in them.
Right, which, I agree with that. You know, the end result was that we didn't end up, we pitched the two-movie package to as many investors as we could kind of get to at that time, and nobody bit. You know, but this was the doldrums of the post-banking crisis, so I don't know if that, you know, how much of that was just nobody was cutting checks for anything at that point, especially in
right.
the movie. We ended up not getting the money through this idea, and we just ended up, well, we've already started making this movie, you know, this documentary as well, and we thought, you know, A, we wanted to use it as a device to get, you know, to try to get Broken Kingdom financed, but we also wanted, we thought it would be, you know, A, a good film, but also B, something that's kind of, that no one else has talked about, and that for younger filmmakers, people coming up, you know, especially like when I was in film school, no one ever talked about financing. No one ever talked about, you know, that it can be difficult or different ways that you can get money for your movies or the different, you know, financial structures. So without, you know, I don't want to pitch Kingdom Come being a movie that's like a class, but
right.
it does have a narrative, and it's pretty lighthearted and pretty humorous, I think, for the most part. But it's going to help somebody, you know, it's going to help 25-year-old me who's, you know, trying to make a movie.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio. On
KISO
88.7 Avalon.
I mean, I think it's a very complete kind of film, even as a documentary, because it's pretty raw, you know, and I'm a pretty big fan of documentaries. I've worked on a few myself. So, I mean, for me, it's definitely something that we appreciate having at the Film Society for people to see, because we're pretty, just like our film festival, we're pretty much sticklers on quality and, you know, what goes into the festival and represents what we choose. So when I saw Kingdom Come, first of all, I know you had it just completed by the time the festival came around. We literally didn't have any more slots to fill because it was so close to the festival.
Yeah.
We really wanted it at the time, but we already sent out all of our invites, and you know, we weren't
sure.
We didn't have any more time. So that's why I'm glad you could see it, but. It's a good piece. It's thorough. I mean, it's thorough. I mean, it's kind of a thorough all around, you know, what do the big wigs think? And let's get into Kingdom Come, because I think what you see as a lay person, not in the industry, you wonder, even if you can get all these stars in a documentary, or even if there's a Rachel Lee Cook involved or a Daniel Gillies involved who's had, you know, his career, people expect these type of actors to be riding around in limousines every day, you know, and they don't know the hardcore reality of still paying mortgages and still kind of making ends meet. So I think a lot of your main audience that would see this that aren't industry related are going to think, well, why couldn't they just fund it themselves?
Right. Which, you know, is actually, I mean, that is the perception, which is interesting because, you know, I know Daniel and Rachel very, very well, obviously. You know, they are working actors, but they're not, I mean, the difference between what somebody like, you know,
Brad Pitt makes on a movie versus what, you know, a working actor in town, even if you know who they are because they've been around for a long time, you know, what the difference between the kinds of money that these people are making. You know, Daniel and Rachel have a mortgage. Daniel and Rachel can't afford, you know, Bentleys. You know, it's just not where they're at. But since, you know, and even, you know, before I sort of got into this business and started to know people like this, you know, the perception is, well, I know who you are. You're famous, so you must be super rich. It's not true. It's, you know, they're not crying poverty, certainly. They're doing well, but they're not the 1%. So they don't have the kind of money where they can write a check for $1 million to finance their own little film. Like, that's not the kind of wealth that we're talking about.
Right, but that is the perception, you know. I mean, industry people understand that, and you know, you can go to their houses and you can see the mortgages and you can see the, you know, that they're not, like you said, living in poverty, but or hand to mouth, but they're definitely comfortable. But I think, you know, if you show this documentary or if you show the film to Middle America or New England, where I'm from, people are going to say, but that's so-and-so. Of course they could make that movie. Of course. Well, why are they begging for money? It doesn't make sense. Why don't they just write a check? And, you know, I think that's the beauty of Kingdom Come, is that you really – I mean, I think maybe in the back of someone's head, because it's never truly addressed. You know, I mean, you see Rachel Lee Cook and she's being interviewed, and this is Daniel, who's the principal of the film, and this is his wife, and she's talking about her struggles and how long is this going to be our life. But I think in the back of the average person's head, is they're still saying is, well, why didn't they just write their own check? Did they just not want to use their own money? You know, and I think Kingdom Come kind of shows that, you know, one, I mean, never really addresses we can't afford it ourselves to do this, but obviously that's kind of what you're watching. You're watching that I can't afford to do this and find out how I can.
Right.
You know, and you know, but I guess where I'm saying the fuzzy line is, people will say, how much of your own money do you dip in to finance this before you hurt personally? You know, if you have all of this love and passion, you know, did Daniel give a lot of his own besides just not taking jobs? I mean, I don't know if I got that from the documentary as much as, you know, he was looking for the financing.
Yeah, I mean, well, the part of it that, initially, without Daniel ended up spending, God, now at this point, he's got to have spent the better part of his income over the last, since he went back to acting after the movie, after Broken Kingdom was done. And he spent a lot of his own personal money. I don't want to.
You don't have to throw figures out there, but that's kind of what I think. Even I, as a professional, were going, well, how much did he put in of himself? You know, without a figure.
He certainly put in as much as he had, certainly at most of the time too. And the interesting thing to sort of that you end up finding out going through these processes, especially Daniel's a very generous and sort of he's very much a gentleman about these kinds of things. But you know, when you're going out to meetings with, you know, potential investors or what we call money finders around town, it's, you know, it's never these people who are picking up a check. It's, generally speaking, it's Daniel. You know, he's that guy. So over the course of, you know,
well, you're also courting them.
To do this,
you kind of do that.
Sorry?
I said you're also courting them, so you kind of do that to get them.
Yeah,
involved.
I mean, it's the classic, you're trying to wine and dine these people and you know, to get them interested in your project and to get them to hear you out and that whole thing. And over the course of 3 years, you know, that adds up. That adds up quite a bit. You know, we went around kind of all around the world to try to find this money. So we, you know, we would go to Colombia, we would go to Germany, we would go to Miami a couple of times. So it's sort of like, you know, those trips add up too. It's not just sort of
right,
check directly to production. Like, this is money that technically, you know, would be earmarked as like development funds if you're at a studio.
Right.
But you know, it's all coming out of your pocket and it's disappearing. when you're doing an indie film like this.
Right. So, I know producers that won't even start projects without $50,000 just for the pre-production part of it, just for the development stage. You know, independent producers, not studio. And that's exactly for that, you know, and one of them is J. Todd Harris, and I say his name because he even gives lectures on this, so he's not shy about it, but he doesn't take on any project. He did, he produced The Kids Are All Right with Mark Ruffalo and Bottle Shock and a bunch of other different films, and he said that, I have a mortgage to pay and kids to take care of and a wife. He's like, I don't take on a project without a guaranteed $50,000. He's like, I have to buy shirts and I have to take dinners and I have to go on trips and I have to, you know, get people involved. So I think the fact that you took this on, it takes us to your debt that's in the film.
Oh yeah.
So you're showing your bank statements and you're looking at real addresses that you didn't blur out and stuff like that. I'm like, wow, he's brave.
Well, you know,
where'd that come from?
Really honest. We wanted to be really honest about what the reality was, what was happening in our lives and all of that. And yeah, you know, most of my debt, I should say, came from, you know, the typical thing that I was doing before Broken Kingdom was I would be on a film, I would produce something, because I never really got fees for producing on films, because, you know, indie films, it's like the first thing to go when you're squeezed for money on an indie film is the, you know, top of the line, above the line, people getting their, you know, just waiving their fees so that you can put it back into the movie, right? So that's always kind of the way that it goes, and I'm used to that. But what would happen is, you know, you'd be working on a movie for 6 months as a producer for no money, and then you go and you do something where you can actually make a good chunk of change, and during those 6 months when you're on the movie, you know, you're dipping into your money, you're dipping into all your savings, you're dipping, you're chewing through your checking account, and then a lot of times you end up, you know, by the old days, I mean, before 2008, you would run up some credit card debt, and then you just pay it off once you were working again for money. I did that many times over. I would just go in and then, I'd end up with 10 grand in credit card debt when I got out of it. And then I'd just get a good gig where I was making 3 grand a week for a few weeks and then it would be gone. And then you just go back and do more indie film things. So, yeah, it's this sort of cycle. And then, you know, my debt that we showed.
Oh, I've never done that. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, and that's the thing, it's like, that's one of those things that I never really heard people talk about, but we all do it in the industry, and it's really stupid, but we all do it because that's the only way that you get to work on these things that you're really passionate about, you know, for most of us. Some people have rich daddies or, you know, have made so much money on their own that they can kind of do what they want. I'm not in either of those boats, so I had to sort of repeat that cycle.
But you had to move in with your sister.
Yeah, I lived with.
It's all in the movie.
Brother-in-law. I lived on their futon for a few months. I lived on another friend's, also a futon for a year, I think. And you know, it's not a particularly comfortable living. You know, you're asking people to do substantial favors for long periods of time. And you don't have your own space, and it's all this stuff. But it's also, you know, you're doing it because you're dedicated to something that you've committed to, or I was in my case. And you know, it's not like you're living on the streets. You're still, you know.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio.
KISO 88.7
Avalon.
Well, John, I have two questions for you based on what you just said. Because even after watching the film, the things I wanted to ask you were, one, why was this your battle? Because it seemed like it was Daniel's, and it seemed like he's the one that was really gung-ho in making this. How did this end up becoming your passion, your battle as well? And, you know, why the debt because of it? And two, when you were, you know, with your sister-in-law on her couch, why didn't you just move in with Daniel if this was kind of like both of your cause? Or stay on his couch.
Right. Well, let's see. So how did it become my battle? Well, Daniel, it didn't start out as my battle, certainly. I was passionate and I was committed to him, really. It's like I felt like to go this deep into the woods with somebody and then cut bait and run, was wrong, and I felt like I didn't want to abandon my friend. That was kind of it. I mean, this was his passion project. This was, and people's passion project, it's not like the Brad Pitt does a small movie. It's like this is something that he had to do, that he had to sort of exercise. And it was out of love and loyalty to Daniel, really, that I got into it. And you get into it further, it becomes yours. It becomes, your quest, sure. And you don't want to give up and you don't want to fail at something.
I see the tears in his eyes. I don't want to give too much of the movie up before people see it. But, my question was, because, I have my best friends, and I'd be like, well, dude, come crash with me. If your sister-in-law is like, I don't know how much longer he can do this. I don't know what he's doing this for. I would just think he'd be like, why don't you just come crash with me while we're doing this?
Yeah, no, it's actually... I guess the reason that never really came up was because it was never really an uncomfortable thing with when I was staying at, my buddy Wes's place, or when I was staying at my sister's place. I wasn't aware of it, so it was uncomfortable.
Okay. I thought there was some tension.
There was never really there was never much tension with my sister, or I had some, sort of tension with another member of my family, my father, at the time. But, he lives in North Carolina, and my sister lived in L.A. at the time. So, it wasn't – there was no, like, hey, get out of our house kind of vibe. It was
Maybe she was just being honest in the interviews, and it just seemed like, she was, like, being, I guess, judgmental of, like, your career choice and just kind of wanting you to – a little bit better of quality of life, and it just seemed like if she's giving him that every day, that might not be the best living situation. But we're just seeing snippets, in the documentary, and maybe she was being honest in an interview, and you weren't hearing that every day. My thing was like, man, if she's giving him every day, like, maybe that you want to look into something else, maybe you want to get a job,
Oh no! Yeah. Well, I think that was her speaking to what my father was saying to us at the time. So I don't think that she was. I don't think that she was at the time thinking that, or even believed that after the fact when that interview was shot. I think she's just sort of, she's your big sister though. At the same time, she's going to be concerned about you. She's going to want you to have a little more stability. She's, it's natural.
Sure.
Natural for anybody who cares about somebody else to want them to have kind of an easier road. And unfortunately, Daniel and I did not give anyone that comfort during this period of time.
That's funny. Now, did you ever get out of debt, or did you just file?
I filed, man. I ended up so far in debt that there was no way for me to get out other than to kind of try to clear some of it off. And
did you say that in the documentary? I don't remember.
I said I was going to in the documentary, but it hadn't happened yet. But it did happen. Yeah, so I'll be living with that wonderful, wonderful stigma for 7 to 10 more years.
You know what? I mean, in this economy, I can honestly say that people seem to judge less, and even when you talk to landlords and stuff like that, their first question is, "Well, was the BK in the past 1 to 2 years?" And then they judge the potential tenants based on that rather than, they're delinquent. I just think it was such a crazy recession that you may have done it in a good time where people won't judge you so harshly, is what I'm saying.
Right. No, I kind of, I actually agree with that. It was not a, when I went down to the court down in L.A., downtown L.A., it was pretty busy that day. So I think that, unfortunately, with the banking crisis and the housing market crash, it, you know, a lot of people got really badly hurt. You know, my debt was probably, was really the result of my own doing, as opposed to some people who were just got hit by very, very bad investment bankers making, you know, doing derivative mortgage deals that were just terrible, terrible for the world. Predatory lending and all that, you know. So I own my own debt, what have you.
Sure. You weren't a victim.
No,
well,
I wasn't in it. But
you were self-inflicted wounds.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it worth it?
Yeah, it was worth it, man. If I personally, I couldn't live with myself if we hadn't done everything we, you know, could to get Broken Kingdom made.
Sure.
You know, it's my, Daniel's a brother to me, and you know, Rachel's a sister to me, and I can't imagine, I would have a hard time living with myself if I had abandoned them or hadn't gone all the
no,
way.
No, but I mean, you know, was it worth it for you even artistically? Was it worth it for you professionally, you know, like more of a fulfillment thing rather than a financial thing?
You know,
I mean, I know you definitely did it in honor of them and for, you know, defending what you signed up for, but I mean, you personally, you know, it was a good journey, right?
It was a good journey. I mean, you know, as far as the thing about producing is, I'm not sure that you're ever, your job is not to be artistically fulfilled. Your job is to serve the vision of the you know, creative force, which is in any film, and I'm talking only in any film, I'm not talking about, you know, studio film or TV or whatever, but yeah, it's, you know, your job is to serve that person's creative vision, that person being generally in any film, the writer, director. So are you going to be personally, creatively fulfilled by anything you ever produce as an indie film producer? I don't think so.
Was it an arduous situation with the documentary then, or did you feel, as the writer, director, editor of the documentary, did you somewhat feel creatively fulfilled with that, or was it just an arduous thing that you had to get done because it was kind of a package deal?
No, I definitely feel very proud of what we did with the documentary. I feel, you know, it's more of a creative endeavor for me because it was something that I was creatively behind. You know, it was ultimately, it was my idea that we started that Daniel and Rachel and I worked on, and then they went off and did their own stuff, and then Paymon Kalea, my co-director, co-editor, co-everything, came in, and we worked on it together, and I was sort of the through line. I was there at the beginning, and I was there for the end. It's so that was creatively very fulfilling for me, and it's always going to be a little weird because, you know, I am in it, and I'm also not as an actor as a real guy in a movie. And so, Daniel, and you're seeing us at probably the hardest times of our lives to that point. So it's sort of like, well, I'm exploiting myself by doing this. But,
yeah.
You know, hopefully for the greater good for the independent film kids coming up. It's like something that we feel really strongly would be a great thing for them to see and then be able to kind of learn.
You know what? It's honest. It's honest. It's sincere. And you know, you guys are endearing because of it. And I think that is what, I think that's what people are drawn to. So, I mean, you know, I think if you didn't give of yourself that much, the respect there, if you gave of yourself and it just looked gratuitous or it looked like you're exploiting just for the sake of, it might be a little bit more of a dirty taste after. But you guys are very endearing because it's raw.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I hope so. That's what we set out to do. And, you know, we did a little premiere of the documentary here in L.A. And I don't know how old you are, but I'm 34 and I grew up.
You're how old?
In the States and what's that?
You said you're how old?
I'm 34.
Okay, I'm 37.
Yeah, so same wheelhouse. When I was growing up, you know, it was the heyday of Beverly Hills 90210, and we were all obsessed with the show. And at the documentary premiere, Jenny Garth was there, who played Kelly Taylor on 90210,
And she came up to me after, and she was like, hey, I'm a fan of you. So getting to meet Penny Garth was like, oh, man, it was all worth it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really cool, man.
And
yeah,
very,
no, it's like those little moments. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, they felt the struggle, too, because they had a pretty quick, you know, decline after their rising. And so I'm sure they've tasted some of that independent fire on other levels post 90210, you know?
Well, it's been interesting. I mean, I can't speak specifically to those guys, but, you know, everyone that I've talked to that has sort of had this reaction to the documentary has been like, you know, I can really relate to it, which is the interesting thing. People from very different walks of life, too, where it's sort of, you know, because it's, you know, it's Don Quixote story. It's we're, you know, we're these two sort of idiots out there trying to achieve this goal, or, you know, and it's everyone can kind of, anyone that's ever tried to do, what was the Dan Harmon quote? Dan Harmon gave us a quote, who's the creator of Community and really sort of a comic hero. His quote is something to the, it's really sad that I can't remember his quote about our movie that we put on the box. But this movie should be seen by anyone who's ever tried to do anything, something like that. So it's sort of a lot of people have related to it because it is about people, you know, out there trying to achieve a dream, and that's a universal thing, which is nice.
Right. Well, you know, it's not, you know, I've produced films, and I definitely empathize. I think I didn't go all out as far as you guys did, because I haven't really gone all out with my own, you know, money with a feature. But, you know, shorts, I think, sometimes are a little bit more attainable for people. But
yeah.
I can definitely relate on a film festival level, because that it rang true a lot of times as I was watching the documentary to what we try to do at the film festival. You know, I mean, it takes a mountain that you have to bring over to an island.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't recommend that people you know, go and do what we did. I think that there's a, you know, part of it is a cautionary tale. Well, don't be a bit more cautious, maybe be a bit smarter than the way that we did it, and you'll probably come out of it without, you know, going bankrupt or having a nervous breakdown, hopefully.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio.
KISL
88.7 Avalon.
I mean, you know, I agree. If they can avoid it, avoid it. And I tell people all the time, you know, as great as things look, and, you know, you got to understand the sweat and blood and tears that it got to get there, you know, it got us to get to do what we tried to do. But, you know, I also believe that, you know, I mean, as I have my little sayings in my office with Ralph Waldo Emerson, nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm, or, you know, the Lucretia said, constant dripping hollows out of stone. You know, I think that sometimes it just takes it. I think sometimes, you know, if you don't, like you said, have an extra $3, $4, $5 million lying around, you've kind of got to do the dirty work, and you've got to go and do it. And it hurts sometimes, and it takes a toll on you, and it taxes you. But sometimes that's what it takes to do it, you know? So, I mean, if people can avoid it, great. I'm happy for them. I don't know if they've got it that comfortable. I'm not sure if they've got the same fire that you guys did to get it done on the way you did it. You know, you guys, you definitely see your heart and soul in both the documentary and the film. So that translates. So, you know, it's that intangible sort of element that the audience feels that I'm not sure if it's an easy street sort of production, you're going to get that same fire and grit.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different ways, not just the way that we approach the actual period of time that we were trying to make the movie. You know, there are a lot of different elements. You know, we were like, well, we're going to commit to this and do nothing else, which, not, you know, isn't necessarily a wise thing to do.
Right.
But there are a number of other elements to what we were doing that would have made it easier.
you know, there are, if there are, you know, sort of small part, and people do this all the time, and you sort of, it depends on what kind of movie you're trying to make, but you can always, if you can get to the right people, you know, the right actors, if you can get somebody in your movie, even for a little part, you know, it makes it easier. It really does, and it makes you kind of sick going through it because you hate to play that game when you're making a little indie film, but if you can find a way to get somebody who's got foreign value that'll help you finance your movie, it's going to save you a year. You know, it's going to save.
Well, you couldn't write in a migrant traveler somewhere in South America that stopped in the same bar as Daniel's character, that was Ryan Gosling. I mean, you couldn't do that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. It's Bradley Cooper.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, you know, it
happens. People backpack.
But you know, there are ways to do it. There are ways to do it if you're willing to do it. There are a lot of different ways. And you know, this was a particularly tough sell, I think, to investors because it's not a genre movie. It doesn't have, you know, Rachel and Daniel are both names, but it doesn't have, you know, a giant, massive movie star in it who has massive foreign value and a little indie drama. It's got kind of dark subject matter. So when you're trying to do that, you know, you're setting yourself up for a more difficult battle from the onset.
So sure.
If you can find out the ways to kind of mitigate that, then you'll be, you know, you'll be better off. You'll probably be able to do it in less time, and you'll sort of suffer less, I think.
Well, what are you doing now, and what do you have coming down in the future? I mean, you're still young. You're 34. This was a learning experience, so you can do it better the next time.
It's true, I could. You know, I'm not, well, currently I'm trying to finish both of these movies, and both the movies are technically finished, but we're releasing them. We're still sort of shopping them to various outlets, and we're trying to get them out into the world in a way that honors them and get them seen, essentially. So we're doing that, and that takes up a bit of time still. You know, I honestly, people ask me that, like, oh, what are you doing next? I don't have anything lined up. I'm not necessarily looking for any film producing thing right now, just because I'm kind of into taking a little break and relaxing as much as that's possible for someone like me.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, working on my own stuff. I actually got into the business to try to be a writer, and I kind of got away from that somehow. So I've been writing stuff with friends who, you know, are far more talented than myself, and you know, a buddy of mine who's actually, he's in the documentary, Wes Nickerson, he's a veteran, Hostile Eyes with Don Cheadle, and he's on Entourage for years. And another friend, Darren Bolitsky, yeah, who's the showrunner on Stevie TV, which is a comedy show on VH1, doing stuff with those guys, and kind of trying to figure out what I want to do next, man.
Well, as long as you write the initial skeleton and let them polish it for you, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm hoping to take advantage of them and ride their coattails. That'd be fantastic.
Hey, it's a collaborative effort. There's nothing wrong with that. Everyone gets their credit. Some people get Oscars doing that. I'm not even going to say who, because I don't want to call them out publicly.
A lot of people.
They do. You know, I mean, as long as you have the initial idea and it's a good sound idea, you'll get a lot of writers that are willing to polish it for you. That's not a big deal.
Yeah.
How was the film festival circuit for you?
It was good. You know,
You didn't do many.
What's that?
You didn't do many.
No, we didn't. And there was a reason for that. You know, initially for Broken, I think we got all of these sort of conflicting pieces of advice on when to send your movie to a film festival. And I, you know, film festival programmer's job in theory is to be able to watch a rough cut or watch something, and you can probably speak to this with a lot of expertise. You know, what you're supposed to, in theory, be able to do is watch a rough cut and be able to imagine what this thing will be when it's done. So for Broken Kingdom, we had heard that, and we had heard the exact opposite of don't ever send anything to anyone until it's absolutely done. So the cuts sound mix, everything. So we ended up going, well, of course, you know, the film programmers, this is their job. This is what they do all the time. So we started submitting to festivals way earlier than we should have, I think. You know, the movie was 30 minutes longer than it ended up being. It, you know, like I said, there was a complete storyline that took place in Bogota that we ended up cutting out that was not cut out until after we had sent it to Sundance. You know, Sundance was like, oh, we really like it. Nice guy, John Nine, I don't know how to pronounce his name. But he sent us a note and was like, hey, I'm going to recommend it to Rebecca because we don't have a slot for it, but it seems like something really up their alley. So we didn't get into Sundance. We didn't get into Tribeca. We ended up sort of going, well, oh, you know, we probably shouldn't have sent it out like this because now we've used up, you know, our submissions to two of the biggies. And, you know, sure. Once you've submitted to the big ones, you can't really – they're not going to want to see it. So, and you get this sort of stigma of you've been rejected already. So the movie's right. Off the road.
Because it's the same people that watch it the second time around.
Yeah. And
if they watch it, because they've already seen it.
If they watch it, if it's not an intern. Because if you look at the numbers of the submissions going to, you know, Sundance, it's there's like 15,000 movies every year going to Sundance now.
Yeah, it's insane.
There aren't enough human beings that work at Sundance to watch that many movies in that period of time. So they must be farming it out to, you know, kind of kids, or they must be, you know, just not watching some of them, you know, half the movies or something like that. I don't know. But, yeah, so
I can't comment on that. I don't know how Sundance operates, and I'm not going to be held accountable for saying the wrong thing.
I don't blame you. But I mean, the thing that we definitely learned from this experience was when we ended up going to Rhode Island with it and premiering, which was really fun, and it was a good festival, and we were happy to do it. But it was a 30-minute different movie with, you know, totally different music and all these other things that, you know, when it was finished, when we took it to Rhode Island. So what we learned was absolutely don't let anyone tell you that you should send it out before it's ready. Don't send it out before it's ready.
I would never do that. I would have told you that too.
Yeah. I wish we had heard both about. We shouldn't have done it.
Well,
so
even with our festival, we tell you that you can submit while it's still in a rough cut. But, you know, there's two things that go on. One, we are using our professional scrutinizing eye to go, this could be better if it's a professionally scrubbed version and we hear the audio problems and you admit to audio problems. But okay, we can tell overall quality that this could be polished and it'll be ready. That's number one. That's if we give it enough attention.
Right.
The second part of it is it's being compared by all the other perfectly finished products. So even though we're accepting it in a rough cut version, we're still comparing it to all the really good polished gems that we saw before and after it.
Yeah.
So there's something that kind of, you know, just doesn't feel good about it, even though we know we're watching a rough cut. And it's got to be an amazing content sort of film for you to go, okay, this can be polished and ready for the festival.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio.
KISO
88.7 Avalon.
Yeah, see, I think that's great to know. I mean, that's something that I think that, you know, younger filmmakers especially coming up, like, they should know that because, you know, because there is so much advice contrary to that out there that I wish I had taken, that we had taken for Broken Kingdom. And I remember, you know, Eddie Burns, who's in the documentary, was talking about Brothers McMullen when he sent it to Sundance, and he was, you know, he got a call from the head of Sundance saying, hey, I like this rough cut, what are you going to cut out, because it's kind of long, and, you know, Eddie talked to him about what he was going to cut out, and they said, all right, well, that sounds great, well, let's do it, let's program it, and, you know, Eddie is the first guy to tell you that would never happen today, because that was 91 or 92 or whatever it was, and it's like there were probably 500 movies that were submitted to Sundance that year. Now there's 15,000, so it can't happen that way anymore. It's just totally different. Sure. So that kind of tactic, it doesn't work. It doesn't make sense anymore.
Well, you know, the other thing is too is everyone has a semi-professional camera now, So everyone's shooting, and they're sending everything.
Yeah, and absolutely.
So Ed Burns didn't compete with that. You know, he was just competing with other probably 35mm films submitted.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, you know, in those days, you know, Eddie was not, that was his first movie. Nobody knew who he was. Nobody knew who Connie Britton was at the time. You know, I wonder if there's this sort of thing about, especially Sundance, where it's every year you look at it and it's like there's two or three movies that don't have massive stars in them. And then everything else is Joseph Gordon-Levitt or James Franco or, you know, the level of movies that they get there, it doesn't seem to be an independent film festival anymore, you know, other than, you know, the budgets are slightly lower than they are on major studio films, certainly, and
right.
The concept's a bit edgy, but it's the same people in those movies. It's amazing. It's like, you know, I love Steve Carell. It's confusing to see him in a festival, you know, at Sundance.
An independent, right.
I think
Robert Redford said in the press he's trying to bring back more of that indie feel that, you know, he even started the Institute on. And we just started the Catalina Film Institute a couple of weekends ago. You know, our whole thing is, you know, doing exactly that, is having those independent grassroots sort of films and filmmakers coming to the island from all over the world. That's kind of, you know, where you start off, but, you know, you feel their pain because it gets really commercial and the studios really do want to get in there and the film market kind of gets crazy and people start throwing money around and sponsorship and, you know, it's a balance that you really have to go, what's an independent film these days? I mean, you know, to me, and I think we talked about this at the film festival after, I think it was after your screening or, no, I'm sorry, it was after the documentary of Stan Lee, With Great Power. But we talked about what an independent film is these days, and I compared it to microbrews for beer. It's like it used to be a microbrew, but now, you know, the bigger conglomerates are owning them. And, you know, Samuel Adams is a big corporation now, even though it was a microbrew, and all these little other tiny microbrews are owned by Budweiser and owned by other companies where you may have stars that are going, you know, below their pay scale, but it's still a Magnolia Pictures film. It's still an independent, even though Rob Reiner directed and Morgan Freeman starred. You know, so, I mean, it's really weird how they're categorizing these independents.
Yes, it's hard to know. And, you know, the idea of where did the money come from being the defining factor for what is independent, what is not. I mean, that's really what independent means, is that it's independent from the studio system. You know, in theory, Lord of the Rings was paid for with more than half of the money, you know, coming from outside of the traditional studio system. So is the Lord of the Rings trilogy an independent trilogy?
It's a Peter Jackson independent.
Yeah, right. You know, I don't know. It's strange because the perception versus the reality of the money thing is it's usually so wildly different than you think it is. And every year there's a couple of movies, little low budget indie movies that come out that actually break out in the marketplace and do really well. And that fuels the sort of the Cinderella story that you see where, oh, this is nobody brought his movie to Sundance and sold it to Weinstein Company for $5 billion and it's this huge hit at the box office. And, you know, the reality is that very rarely happens.
Right. And even Weinstein, I mean, they're pretty much doing their own independence themselves, but it's coming with bigger names and it's coming, you know, My Week with Marilyn, independent film, but, you know, Oscar-nominated actress at the helm, at the front, and then a lot of these other films. I mean, The Artist is probably a true independent. They really pushed.
Right. When they were doing their model back in the day was great as far as they would pick stuff up like The Artist. A lot of foreign films, a lot of little true indie films, and they would throw 10 of them against the wall. Harvey Weinstein's just famous for that. Throw 10 against the wall, and whichever one kind of stuck and took off, you know, he would promote and do a massive Oscar campaign, and they would make all their money on their slate back from generally one or two movies.
Sure. Yeah.
Until Pulp Fiction.
We're making pitches. Yeah, I mean, you know, these are good things that I think kind of relate to Kingdom Come, because even a lot of questions we get at the Film Society are how come these films aren't in the mainstream theaters, you know, something like A Broken Kingdom. And I try to tell them all the time, I'm like, it looks the part, it feels the part, it's the real thing. I'm like, it's genuine. But there's so much in the system that's up against these films succeeding or just doing a mediocre sort of run that you don't even know half of it. You know, yes, it's a beautiful film, and yes, it should be in theaters, but, you know, if there's not, like you said, if it's not the right genre or it's not genre-specific, there's not an audience that they want to invest in to deliver it to. And, you know, there's a lot of, like, fine weights and balances that you deal with as an independent filmmaker and the journey that, you know, your film takes, no matter how many years you put into it and how many debts you racked up, you know. So I think independent film has taken a whole new sort of, you know, step away with the Weinstein companies with the bigger engine behind it, but you know, it's independent films almost become big independent now, and the littler films are kind of left to just kind of maybe do the festival circuit and then try to find some sort of distribution after the fact, whether it's Netflix or video on demand or something.
Yeah.
You know, and it's an interesting time, because I think whoever kind of grabs hold of these reins is going to become the next mogul if they can really figure out how to get independent film, smaller independents, back into the flux.
Yeah, and it's so cost prohibitive for, you know, an indie film especially with sort of not known talent, but even, you know, even with talent in it that people know, it's so cost prohibitive to try to go and do a theatrical release of any kind. Even if it's in New York and L.A., once you've finally completed the monumental task of financing and producing and editing and, you know, all those things, your movie, then you get to the point where you're like, well, let's release this baby. And
right.
Well, I want to do in New York, a week in L.A., and that's going to cost me at least $200,000. that's terrifying. I mean, you know, that's money that it's so astronomical compared to what you have, you know, sort of to work with, that it's so cost prohibitive that most indie film producers and companies can't afford to do that at all. So everyone's looking
right.
for alternative ways to monetize and and Kevin Smith is really good at finding different ways to play their movies in theaters or on sort of small tours around the country, and at the same time releasing them on VOD and releasing them on iTunes and having them sort of be promoted elsewhere so that they're kind of gathering this publicity storm as much as possible. And, you know, there's no set distribution model left for indie film distribution. It's like the Wild West, and everyone's trying to figure out
right.
a way to do it. So if someone...
How creative can you be?
Model, yeah, I mean, there's a million different ways to do it. And it's kind of... It's interesting because you don't have to stick to the windows that... the traditional windows of theatrical, then DVD and VOD, then, you know, Netflix, then iTunes, that kind of the pattern that everyone's been doing forever. You don't have to do that anymore. It's riskier not to do it, but you don't have to do it. And especially if you're, you know, scrappy little underdog, you know, you have a shot at reaching your audience without doing the crazy, crazy cost prohibitive theatrical release that no one can afford anymore.
Sure.
So it's an interesting time, and hopefully there'll be a model that comes out of this that's fantastic for everyone.
Well, John, thank you so much. I appreciate it, and I look forward to screening the film so people know what we're talking about with Kingdom Come. So we appreciate it. We really do. John Lyons Murphy, the co-director, co-writer, producer, and editor of Kingdom Come, based on the film Broken Kingdom, It's the Making Of, that was in the Catalina Film Festival 2012 and won our Avalon Best Feature Award. So come out and check it out. And John, thank you again.
Thank you, and I hope you enjoy the movie.
John Lyons Murphy, who is the co-director, co-writer, and producer and editor of Kingdom Come. It's playing this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Hotel Metropole Conference Room. And you can come out and see his documentary film with A-list stars Mark Ruffalo, Don Cheadle, Ed Burns, Kevin Smith. It's basically the making of the movie Broken Kingdom, which won the Avalon Best Feature Award at the 2012 Catalina Film Festival this year, with Daniel Gillies, who wrote, directed, and produced that film, and also starred his wife, Rachel Lee Cook, who also attended our 2012 film festival.
Catalina Film Radio.
KISO
88.7 Avalon.